Okay, I think we can get started. Erev Tov, those of you on the East Coast. So Harayim Tov in Australia, almost, it's 11:30 a.m. on Friday morning. It's almost Shabbos, but it's the summer. They're in summertime, so service is a little later. Welcome everybody, and welcome Rabbi Blackman. I want to thank Louise Katz for sponsoring this evening's shiur in memory of her father, in observance of Yahrzeit for her father, Avram Ben Zusman. The neshama should have an aliyah. We should have good health and a long life. Of course, I picked that up marrying a South African, that we wish people long life on a Yahrzeit, as you know well. Rabbi Blackman grew up in South Africa, spent time as a leader in Bnei Akiva, moved to spend 10 years in Israel at Yeshivat Har Etzion, became a close student of Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, and he has been living in Australia for the last 25 years as the rabbi of the Jewish Learning Center in Sydney, Australia, and which is involved in the Kiruv, teaching, outreach, and it's a pleasure to welcome him back, really from Mamash, from around the world, from more than halfway around the world. I want to welcome you, and tonight's shiur, I believe, is entitled Dust and Salt, great topic for Parshat Vayera. Bavakasha, Rabbi Blackman.
Kelman, thank you so much for inviting me onto the resume here of speakers once again. Appreciate it, and good evening to all of you, and looking forward to sharing some good Divrei Torah with you. Dust and salt, I'm sort of putting it together over the last few days, was to try and get a little bit of an interesting perspective on these two almost irrelevant elements in our lives, but yet brought to life in this week's Sedra. Parshat Vayera begins by describing the unique midah, the unique character trait of Avraham Avinu, and that is as the Baal Chesed, the man of kindness, the one who has exemplary hachnasat orchim, his hospitality knows no bounds. And even after his Brit Milah, in his incapacitated state, he's yet keen to still entertain guests in his Eishel, in his kind of oasis in the middle of the desert. It's as if almost Hashem is trying to help him out and allow him to recover after this Brit Milah at the age of 99. So Hashem turns up the heat, if you will, and the sun beats down probably hotter than it's ever been. You could probably call it, I don't know what it is in degrees there, but you know, in our centigrade or Celsius degrees, let's say we talk over 50, that's already world record heat. And so possibly this could be interpreted, yeah, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you know, the sun bakes down on such a level. The idea behind it was to keep everybody indoors so they wouldn't bother Avraham Avinu. However, it sort of, if we can call it, backfires on HaKadosh Baruch Hu, if you can use such a term, where Avraham Avinu himself is more overtaken by, he's depressed, the fact that he can't entertain, which sort of like, you know, it puts in perspective his unique characteristics here, that the pain of his recovery is overtaken by the depression that he can't entertain. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu sends the three angels to go and visit Avraham Avinu, and he would then, in a sense, feel better by being able to welcome them in. And at the same time, these three particular angels had unique tasks to fulfill. And but Avraham Avinu doesn't know that they're angels. It doesn't sound like he knows that they're angels. He doesn't think that they necessarily are important people either, because he's somewhat suspicious of them, as the Torah tells us that when he invites them in, he says, "Yukachnam at ma'im v'rachatu raglechem," you know, take some water and wash your feet. And Rashi explains the reason behind this, and that is, Kasavu Shahem Arviim. He thought that they were travelers, and travelers who would bow down to the avak, the dust that is on their feet. And this idea of bowing down to dust, turning the concept of dust into an avodah zorah, is really interesting. Anyway, Avraham Avinu suspected that this was possible, and therefore he asked them to wash their feet before they came into his house. That's what it means. Rashi brings v'hikpid shelo la'achnis avodah zorah le'beito. He didn't want to bring in any type of idol worship into his house. So he puts them under this tree, which is probably outside, and then he goes through this ritual of washing feet. Now, this is a well-known Rashi that shows Avraham Avinu's hospitality wasn't really a symptom of their stature. He considers them people of suspect ideology and therefore goes through this whole ritual of washing their feet. Now, not being that well read up on all the different Avodah Zorahs in the world, but we've never heard of such an Avodah Zorah, you know, bowing down to the dust on one's feet. So this needs to be addressed. And the Maharal in the Gur Aryeh speaks a little bit about this. And he tries to understand how dust can become part of a culture of Avodah Zorah. And he draws our attention to the well-known Rambam, where the Rambam explains the original mistake leading to Avodah Zorah was the feeling that transcendent, infinite Hashem, or God, could not possibly be interested in communicating with finite man. And mankind continues down this path, and they erroneously conclude that the way that they would have a relationship with Hashem was to somehow interact with the lower spiritual powers and the creations of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and find a kind of, not intermediary so much, but rather an intermediate point of contact, and being, so to speak, intimidated by the infinite God, they would find it easier to think of HaKadosh Baruch Hu via focus on something that Hashem himself had created. And they looked around the world and they saw the props that Hashem had put, whether it was in the sky, on the ground, the sun, stars, moon, etc., or it was trees and nature. And they began to use this as a potential intermediary focus to get to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Something similar to a person who works in a particularly big company, in a factory possibly, and the average person thinks that the big boss who owns the company, you know, is not really interested in speaking to them, and they have much more of a chance getting their needs met by talking and developing a relationship with the floor manager. So middle management is much easier to interact with than, you know, high-level management. This is the kind of conclusion that humanity sort of came to, misguided as it was, but that's ultimately what human beings were trying to develop. And it just took a certain amount of time until the intermediary became, in a sense, a deity, and developed a life of its own. And that's how Avodah Zorah was born. But if this particular theory is true, then what the Maharal suggests is that the lower the item in terms of in the eyes of mankind, the easier it is to deal with. And so there's nothing lower than dust. And that became, therefore, a focus of people. And when you take this bad swara to a wrong conclusion, you get to the concept of dust worship. This is how the Maharal looks at this idea of how dust could be Avodah Zorah, and Avraham Avinu was making sure that none of it came into his home. However, it's interesting that the Shaloh HaKadosh has a very different approach. You can find it in his Perush Torah. He sort of looks at it slightly differently. And he says like this. He says, I don't think we even need to explain the rationale behind dust worship. It's not so much the dust worship that really, sort of underpins what's happening here, but rather, let's take an understanding of what's going on that particular day, as we described in the beginning of our discussion. The Torah tells us that it's a ridiculously hot day, a hot day that nobody would be seen walking outside. That was the idea of it. So what was HaKadosh Baruch Hu doing? Hashem brought the sun out, so to speak, and the heat was generated by the sun. Now, says the Shaloh HaKadosh, it's well known that people worship the sun being probably the most powerful star that we encounter directly. And so people used to bow down or worship the sun. Now, the koyach, the power of the sun is in the fact that if you leave something in the sun too long, then what the sun does is it dries it out and ultimately turns it into crumbling dust. And so if you leave a book outside in the sun, you leave anything made out of plastic outside, even anything outside in the sun, it's just a matter of time until all the so-called moisture is sucked out of the item, and the thing just crumbles. And so really, says the Shulchan Aruch, you know, dust is not so much that it's not the worship of the most lowly or worthless entity in the world, like the Maharal thinks, because human beings are looking to not be intimidated by anything. But rather, it's actually the opposite. Dust is the antithesis of worshiping something that's worthless. Dust is actually worshiping the sun. Dust worship is really sun worship, because the koyach of the sun is really seen by the fact that it can cause things to be decompose and ultimately be reduced to dust. And therefore, if a person subscribes to sun worship, which was prevalent in those days, so he actually looks at dust reverentially, because look what the sun did to this. And then you accord dust elevated status because you are a chosid of the sun. So this is really what the Shulchan Aruch suggests is going through Avraham Avinu's mind. He understands that these are dust worshippers, which means that it's a sniff, a branch, a new sect of sun worshippers. The question is, how does Avraham Avinu know? How is he so certain that they were sun worshippers? Now, again, focusing back on Rashi's comment, Rashi tells us what the weather was like on this day. Kechom Hayom, it was so hot that no one in their right mind would ever go outside. And all of a sudden, you see three stooges on teal. So you ask yourself, like Avraham Avinu did, you know, what are these three Meshugoyim doing? Who walks in the desert? You know, they're traveling in the middle of the desert means they've been traveling for a while. You know, who does this? Who comes out on this kind of a day? Nobody in their right mind is going to go on teyul, you know, on such a hot day. Now, of course, we know they're angels, which means that they're weatherproof. And they're coming to do the tafkid Hashem had given them, you know, whether it was to cure Avraham Avinu from the Brit Milah or to give him the Nachat Ruach of the Hachnasas Orochim, you know, or to give the good news that Sarah will have a child and then to move on to Sodom. That's what they were doing there. But in principle, Avraham Avinu is under the assumption that they aren't angels, that they're regular human beings, and he wants to know what are these normal mere mortals doing out on such a ridiculously hot day. And so Avraham Avinu comes to one conclusion. Why are these guys, who's going to walk around on such a hot day? There's only one conclusion, and that these are really frum sun worshippers. Everybody else stays at home. But if you worship the sun, no, you know, it's Simchas Torah. So there's never been a day that the sun has shone like this before. And if there are three people out there on a day like this, this equals sun worship, which equals dust worship, which equals please wash your feet and make yourselves comfy, you know, under the tree, you know, outside. So this is the Shulchan Aruch's interpretation, you know, of what it means here, what the metaphor behind what the idea behind dust worship, you know, is all about. Now there's an interesting philosophical approach where we look at these concepts like dust slightly metaphorically to try and see what deduction, philosophical deduction we can extract from this idea of, you know, of dust and why you would worship it. So we've given a number of perspectives so far. Now I'd like to share with you a lovely insight, a chiddush that I saw in the writings of the Sefer Nachalat Yaakov, which was written by Rabbi Yaakov Milisa, the famous Gaon, who we well know from his Perush on Choshen Mishpat, Nasifas HaMishpat, but he has a Sefer Nachlat Yaakov, and he has a lovely insight explaining what this is, this idea behind dust worship. And he takes us on a little bit of a tangent, so just bear with me as we sketch another principle before we get to answer this idea of the dust. He quotes a Gemara in Masechet Brachot Daf Mem Gimel Amud Bet. The Gemara has a cryptic piece of Agarata, a kind of a lesson to us. And the Gemara says, if a person takes wide steps, the person takes wide steps, psia gasa, it's like your mama is putting effort into wide steps as you walk. Noteret echad, mitafkuf mimo'ore enav. One in 500th of your eyesight is compromised if you are somebody who regulates themselves to engage in a psia gasa. You run and you walk fast, big steps. Okay. The person who does that is going to lose 1/500th of their eyesight. My takante, says the Gemara. What's the antidote for this? Says the Gemara, lahadre b'kiddusha devei shimshay. Make kiddush on Friday night. If you make kiddush on Friday night, that in a sense puts back what you lost. Or that in a sense protects you. It's the antidote to this malady that you might encounter, a certain amount of diminishing of your eyesight as a result of this behavior pattern of psia gasa. That's the Gemara. So Rabbi Yaakov Melissa wants to understand what is the kavana, what's the intention over here? How do you understand this cryptic statement of the Gemara? What lies behind it? What is this calculation of one in 500 of your sight? Where is such a measure hinted to in the Torah? And lastly, how does Kiddush on Friday night sort you out? How does it bring it all back? And so this is what he offers us an insight into answering these questions to explain out the Gemara. And he says as follows. He says that Chazal made a drosha. They deduced from the pasuk in our Sedra where Avraham Avinu asks the three gentlemen that he encounters, V'rachatzu ragleichem, to wash their feet. So again, quotes the Midrash that he thought they were Arviyim. They were desert travelers. Shemishtachavim la'avakshe b'raglehem, who actually bowed down to the dust on their feet. And he was very particular not to bring into his house, he didn't allow anybody past the threshold of his house with anything avodah zarah on their person. Says the Rabbi Yaakov Melissa, he says as follows, that in his mind, this idea of the dust on one's feet and worshipping it is a metaphor. It describes an attitude. And that is a person who has dirty feet. It's almost similar to what we would say in modern times. We'd say, you need to work hard and get your hands dirty if you want to succeed. Getting your hands dirty, I would probably say is the same way in those days of saying, how far did you travel to work? How far did you travel to get what you wanted? The kavana behind it is that a person invests tremendous amount of energy, koyach, effort, in order to earn a livelihood. And the idea behind seeing a person with dirty feet or dust on their feet is that it's a person who puts a lot of trust in his efforts to make a living, and it demonstrates an over investment in one's own prowess in order to earn a living. In a sense, it emphasizes that a person is trusting more in their own koach than in the blessings of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And this is what is called avak avodah zarah. It's an expression which is of course meant to be, a very low level it's a preamble to avodah zarah. But the word avak is sort of telling over here. Avak avodah zarah means the attitude is there. The worship might not be there, but the attitude is there. And the attitude which is is most problematic for humanity is to walk around thinking that it's human koyach, kochiv otzem yadi, it's the power of the human being. The more power, the more success. And therefore, because I want to be successful, I have to invest more and more and more and more time until eventually I cross the line and I lose sight of what's really important in this world because I'm addicted to chasing material things. And a person has to know a big challenge is to find that balance between emunah and bitachon in HaKadosh Baruch Hu and the amount of hishtadlut, the amount of effort a person invests in being successful. That balance we all struggle with. That balance is really tough to really get right. But a person needs to appreciate that from HaKadosh Baruch Hu comes the mitzadei gaver, the ability to walk. The description here is mitzadei gaver, a person walks the steps of a human being. HaKadosh Baruch Hu predetermines, if you will, how successful a person is going to be to a certain point. But a person has to trust in Hashgacha Pratit, in the divine providence of God, and balance the two so that you don't lose sight of the spiritual in pursuit of the physical. A person has to do their ishtadut. There's no question. A person's not allowed to rely on miracles. And you've got to find the middle road over here. And these characters who are described as, desert wanderers with dust on their feet, the implication or what Rabbi Yaakov Milisa sees is they represent people who feel that all of their parnosa comes from their effort spent going from place to place to pick up jobs all over the place. And they represent those who think that one's entire livelihood comes from one's own investment. And that attitude is avak avoy dezora. It's like equivalent of somebody who's bowing down to the grease on your hands, to the dust on your feet. And therefore, Avraham Avinu wanted to teach them that there's this balance that is important to achieve. Rachatzu ragleichem, wash your feet. He wants to try and teach them about belief in HaKadosh Baruch Hu and balance out humanity's addiction to the pursuit of the material with the investment in the spiritual as well. That's how Rav Yaakov Milisa wants to interpret, this Gemara. We'll get to it how he fits it in. But this is the idea. This is the metaphor. Now it's interesting that the same kind of theme is brought to life by the Kotzke Rebbe. The Kotzke Rebbe makes an interesting comment. You'll see how it's quite difficult to apply this, but the Kotzke Rebbe's launchpad for this idea is, again, it's a drosha, it's a deduction that Chazal, the Rabbonim, make, quoted in the Gemara Masechet Tanit Yud Amud Bet. The Gemara talks to a pasuk which describes Yosef and the brothers. After Yosef has revealed himself to the brothers now want to go home. The brothers want to, Yaakov Avinu is sitting at home wallowing in his misery, and they now know that Yosef's alive. Of course, what they want to do is get back home as quickly as possible. So the pasuk says that Yosef told them, "Al tirgizu badarech," don't go mad, don't speed, on your way home, and the Gemara has this drosha, "Al tafsiu psia gaza," don't run. This is an interesting idea. What was Yosef telling the brothers? What was he telling them? So he says, he said to them as follows. He says, look, this entire story of you selling me into slavery and languishing here until you come down and me trying to get you to do tshuva, whatever the rationale behind it all was, this whole entire episode, the brothers realized that, yes, everybody made mistakes. But there was an element here of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Hashgacha here. And that HaKadosh Baruch Hu had ordained that Yaakov Avinu suffer a kind of avelut over his son missing in action for 22 years. And if one really has tremendous faith in HaKadosh Baruch Hu and his divine providence, Yosef is telling the brothers like this: I know that there is no greater motivation that you have now to leave me and get home as quickly as possible. You're going to fly home. But you should realize that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has ordained it such that there's a certain amount of time Yaakov Avinu has to be in Avelus, and he has to be in mourning. And therefore he said to them, don't do more than you would normally do. Don't be dochek et hasha'ah. Don't push it. Because the Hashgacha Pratit, the divine providence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, has worked out exactly how this is supposed to be. And, you know, this idea, you know, needs to be respected. And therefore he told them, you don't put yourselves in danger. You don't do anything out of the ordinary. You just do what you normally would do as an enthusiastic person to do the right thing. And so the time is all calculated by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Don't put yourself in danger. Don't speed. Don't engage in psia gasa to achieve what you think has to be achieved in this world. There's a very, it's a very difficult application of this idea. How much do you put in? How much you don't? How much, you know, how much do you run for that flight? You know, all the different stories that come as a result of being people being a bit late and missing it, people catching it early. It's almost hard to know exactly what to do. But bottom line is, this is the Kotzke Rebbe's derivation from this Medrash Chazal, this Gemara. Al tirgazu badarech, you know, don't travel through the night. Go and stay in a hotel that you stayed in on the way down here, you know. Be normal. That's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants you to put effort, but effort must be calculated. And it must be done in such a way that you demonstrate full belief in the way HaKadosh Baruch Hu runs the world. And full belief is not what we often think it is, that a human being has to put in their physical maximum to achieve something. You know, rather a person has to be in the physical world as normal as you can be. And in the spiritual world, you have to chase much harder. But in the physical world, you have to be as normal as you can be, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Hashgacha, you know, is right behind you. And therefore, you know, don't go psia gasa, and don't travel at night, don't speed, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu's will is that which is going to be fulfilled in any event. And don't yidchaku et hasha'ah, don't push the clock. And this is really another similar type of insight that underpins what the Nesiv HaMishpat is saying as well. You know, there's this kind of strong emunah that a person has to have, an unbelievable balance of recognition of what it is considered respectable effort that one invests in a mission, which is good, and the recognition of HaKadosh Baruch Hu behind the scenes. Now, the Rambam has an interesting phrase with regard to another mitzvah, which is again another tangent of this particular story, but it highlights what we're going to bring together over here. So the Rambam writes in the 12th chapter of the laws of Rotzeach Ushmirat Nefesh, when the Rambam there writes in Aloch Yud Dalad, he talks about the violation that we all have to avoid, and that is to be careful not to violate the din of Lifnei Iver, to put a stumbling block in front of a blind person. It's interesting that even the person is called, the person who's walking simply in the street and is unaware of what somebody else is going to, you know, do, you know, what stumbling blocks one's going to put in front of them, that the person is called an iver. He's called an iver, a blind person. The Rambam interprets that the blindness is not necessarily a physical blindness. You know, it can sometimes be you've got iveret haseichel, where you're not aware. You're a perfectly 100% physically blessed individual. Everything's working great. We use the phrase lifnei iver in front of a blind person. Don't put a stumbling block. But you could be a perfectly healthy person, you know, and you're still called blind because somebody doing something where you're unaware, it's intellectually unaware. And so therefore, even somebody who's intellectually unaware, you know, is the person is considered blind, metaphorically blind. And somebody who violates, you know, your space and creates a scenario by which a stumbling block is, you know, put in front of you and you aren't aware of it, that's called a mikshol. That's called a stumbling block. So we see just from the Rambam's metaphorical interpretation or the idea behind being a blind person is loved after blind. It's intellectually unaware. So you see from here that somebody who's got this intellectual impairedness is also called a blind person. And with this, we can now understand this Gemara. We can interpret the Gemara that a person who takes a large step, who puts in extra effort more than what's required, loses 1/500th of their sight. The idea behind it is that a person who puts in more effort than they should and violates this delicate balance and does speed on the road because you think you're justified because of the ends are justifiable, you know, and therefore when you do that, then you demonstrate that you've lost perspective, kind of a intellectual sight, understanding, a little bit of your perspective, your intellectual awareness of that delicate balance has been compromised 1 in 500. We'll get to the number in a second. And the perspective we're looking to try and master throughout our lives is the balance between knowing what the right amount of effort is, how much koach and otzem yadenu, that means effort needs to be invested, with the belief in what HaKadosh Baruch Hu is doing is for all of our good. The so-called awareness, perspective, the einay of the seichel, you know, has to be measured. And as a result of this idea, the right perspective and balance on issues of material well-being in this world, this may be brought to light by a story that happens right at the end of the people of Israel's stay in the desert. It's a war that they wage with Midian after the debacle, you know, with Bilam and Balak, etc. What happens is that Moshe Rabbeinu is given permission or instructed to go wage war against Midian. And the Torah tells us that when Am Yisrael went to war, they were told as follows, that this war has one or two unique instructions. And one of them is that they could benefit from the spoils of war. And they could come back with whatever they took. They could actually benefit from it. However, when they came back with this, you know, each they were told, take a backpack, you know, fill up what you can. And when they came back, they were told to take 1 out of 500 of what wealth or money, precious metals, valuables they had accumulated, 1/500th of what they took has to be given to tzedakah. That was the interesting measure of tzedakah that was instructed to Am Yisrael under Moshe Rabbeinu's leadership in the last war before he died. And so those people who went out to war, you know, they were taught that when you go out to war, look, it's very difficult for somebody who goes out to war to say, look, we're not going to run. We're going to just walk normally. I mean, war is like war, right? It's like a kind of, well, this is the environment scenario where you have to put in your maximum koyach more than normal. So in a sense that going to war is almost a forced violation of siyag gasa. Okay, fine. What can you do? Hashem has put you in that situation. And then what's beyond your control. It's fine. So you have to, there's an exception to the rule now when you're going to fight and defend yourself. So you have to, you're given permission to physically engage with your maximum. But of course, when a person does engage physically with their maximum, there's always a danger on the other side that you start to think that way too. And being a soldier in an army, the army is not an environment which is spiritually charged. You know, a regular army, you have to really watch yourself because so many base drives come to the fore. And therefore, in order to almost counteract, you know, the perspective that might have been, you know, influenced as they fought this war, they were told when you come back, you got to give tzedakah. You got to give a truma, you know, and the figure that was given there was one in 500s. And the idea behind it was to show that everything belongs to Kosh Baruch. So it's interesting that this number, which we were trying to work out where the Gemara got the number from, yeah, we have a source in the Torah where, you know, the number, let's call it the ratio of what you can keep to what you have to give to tzedakah is quite unique. It's not very much, one in 500. But the fact that the numbers mentioned here within this particular scenario of going to war, trying to be an antidote to an incorrect perspective on your role in the physical universe, specifically because you've been forced to invest physically more than you would normally, we can draw a conclusion that this is what the idea behind it, behind this number is. So when the Gemara comes along and says the following, the Gemara says, what are we trying to tell you? That a person who invests more in their physical well-being than they should shows a certain lack of faith in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and one has to struggle their whole life to get this balance of acceptable investment and faith in HaKadosh Baruch Hu correct. But when a person overshoots that line and does more than they should, the danger is to lose perspective on who runs the world and how Parnosa is given to us. And therefore, this is described in the Gemara. The Gemara says a person who demonstrates that they have overshot the correct line of balance has, in a sense, become blind, one in 500. You've lost your perspective on this unique balance. And the only way to get back, the antidote to correct one's perspective, is beautifully put by the Gemara as being the ability to make Kiddush Friday night. And why is this act of Kiddush Friday night given as the antidote? Is because somebody who keeps Shabbos, as Shabbos, you dedicate, you're a Shomer Shabbos person. So a person who says Kiddush Friday night and praises HaKadosh Baruch Hu, giving us a day, and this particular day forces us to put everything physical aside. You don't do any malacha. There's no work on such a day. Shabbos demonstrates by stopping to work. Shabbos demonstrates that you believe in the divine providence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that the 6 days of work that he allowed you to do is enough and good enough for a good life. And therefore, this attitude is strengthened by the whole concept of Shabbos, that we are developing a perspective of balance between a person's kach and otzem ro is invested in his parnosa and HaKadosh Baruch Hu's hashgacha, and Shabbos brings us all together. And therefore, the Gemara expressed in such a way that a person who does overdo it during the week, you worked too late at the office, and thereby you compromised your family life and your time with your wife and your time learning because you were pursuing that deal. And you thought you have to do it now, even if it means compromising on other values, you're going to do it because you know you're in it. You're in the middle of it. Every week, HaKadosh Baruch Hu forces, you've lost perspective. You carry on doing it too long, it won't be healthy for your whole entire family. HaKadosh Baruch Hu designed the world to protect us. How do you do tshuva? How do you protect against that perspective? You make Kiddush Friday night because that brings a perspective, this balance between a person's personal investment in his well-being and belief in HaKadosh Baruch Hu at the same time. So, yeah, this is a number of perspectives on the concept of dust worship. You know, that's, and we'll leave it there as far as dust ideas that are extracted from this. Just for the remaining bit of time, I'd like to look at a similar kind of exploration and analysis of the nature of salt. Now, when we when we are looking to understand the nature of the metaphor of salt and its role in this week's Sedra, I'm sure you are able to quickly make some connections to salt. But let me start off with a chiddush I found really insightful in the writings of Rav Kook. So Rav Kook made the following gave over the following insight. You may know well the law that when we all sit down to eat bread, the Gemara in Masechet Chulin, Daf Kuf Ayin Bet, the Gemara there tells us that Mayim Rishonim, the reason why we wash hands before we sit down to work, to eat bread, is because Chazal, possibly even Shlomo HaMelech, came up with this idea in order that all of us, all of Klal Yisrael, wash our hands in order to remind the Kohanim who are functioning in the Beit HaMikdash that they have to be very, very careful about remaining pure. Hands specifically should not touch anything impure, because a lot of the food that they're eating has a holy status to us. People are giving them truma. Truma is a tithe of sorts, and it has kedusha. It has holiness. And if they become tamei in some way or form, they will violate eating truma, which is a problem. And so therefore, Chazal decreed that all of Klal Yisrael wash hands before eating bread, which was the staple diet or staple donation tax given to the Kohanim, so that they, the Kohanim, should also do the same. So that's really the idea behind the washing that we have before bread. There's actually another element there too as well, and that is that there's a form of ritual purification over here, you know, almost similar to a partial immersion in a mikveh. So when the Torah describes and the Gemara qualifies what it means when it says "v'hit kadishtem," you shall become holy, the Rabbanim interpret this whole idea that you should wash your hands, and this is the rabbinic decree with its different reasons as well. So this is the rabbinical decree to netilat yadayim, wash hands before meals, in order to you know, it's based on the purification that the Kohanim underwent before eating their truma offerings. Okay, that's the netilat yadayim as we know it. The Gemara in Chulin describes further, and it tells us that there's a concept called mayim acharonim. You know, when you finished eating, you need to wash your hands before benching. You see many people buy all these little nice, you know, tzatzkiri things, mayim acharonim bechas, you know, where you have a little bit of water, you can wash your hands. That's really what we all do. Now, most people, if that, the rationale behind it is quite simple. Most people will wash their hands, you know, after eating a meal where their hands are dirty. So, you know, if you're eating ribs with your hands, you know, you want to get up and do something, you know, you have to wash your hands. So, you know, a finger bowl is sent around and you wash your hands. So when your hands are dirty, obviously you wash your hands. But even if in our day and age where you're eating with cutlery and you're good, you did well. Your hands aren't dirty. So do you still have to wash your hands after the meal? So yeah, this is an interesting discussion. And the Balei HaTosfot, Rashi's grandchildren, they're the ones who make it quite famous that rabbis decree that you need to wash your hands after eating as well. And the reason that you have to wash your hands because in those days you ate with your hands, and it was high probability that there was a content of salt on your hands. And if salt gets into your eyes because you wiped your eyes without cleaning your hands, you could damage your eyes. And they call the salt that is so dangerous, you know, melach sedomit. You know, now let's be honest over here. I mean, it could be any kind of salt, man. And it doesn't have to be sodomite salt. What's melach sedomit? So you could argue with me. You could say, no, it must have been really, really strong salt there. But it applies to anything strong. I remember my kids having this, we had a good laugh or when this happened to one of my kids who didn't listen to us after consuming a container of Mexican chili Pringles, and after doing that, of course you eat Pringles with your hands, right? And then he rubbed his eyes and, he's a little toddler. So he's screaming his way to the bathroom. Can't understand what happened. They say, from then on, you always did Mayim Achronim, right? That's the idea. Of course, that's what you do. But isn't it so interesting that the salt that is used to describe, a material that's going to damage your eyes, Melach Sedomit. Now, Rav Kook takes it to a whole new philosophical level. Says Rav Kook as follows, that we have to understand what is the character trait that really describes people living in Sodom. So it's interesting. Unlike us today, you talk about sodomy, but in the words of Chazal, it's something a little different, that Sodom's immorality can be qualified slightly differently. What were the people of Sodom possessed with? They were possessed with fulfilling their physical desires, self-gratification to the nth degree, so selfish. The Midrashim that talk about Sodom and the rules that they had there, underscore this particular issue. There was such a selfish, self-centered perspective developed by the people of Sodom that it ruled out officially, it was illegal to help people, to give tzedakah, to feed people. It went out of its way to be the most self-centered society in the world. There was no time, there was no effort remaining to do chesed with anybody. It was absolutely, absolutely cruel in that particular regard. And of course, by extension, that defined the pleasures that they had energy to pursue. And so Rav Kook says as follows. He says that's the midah, that's the character trait of Sodom. And so he says that we as human beings who are nowhere near, thank God, as Sodom, the average person's not a Sodom, but you have to realize the following, that there's a certain spiritual peril, danger that is present every time we engage in the pleasure of the physical world. So anytime we sit down to eat a meal, right there, the Yetzer Hara is right there, hoping that we overextend ourselves in that meal, we become over involved in the gastronomic pleasures of what we eat. And we ascribe more pleasure and satisfaction out of the physical than we should. It's, in a sense, it's trying to, a human being has to realize that while you're engaged in something that's pleasurable, you have permission to use it from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But you need to always keep that perspective that physical pleasure is yet but a tool in the hands of the human being to serve Hashem and not as a means in and of itself. And every human being is really challenged with this. And so, says Rav Kook, as a preventative measure, Chazal, the Rabbonim, decreed that we should wash our hands before eating, because this ritual of taking a step back for a second and washing our hands conjures up the imagery that we are like Kohanim in the Beit HaMikdash, eating holy bread, baked from Truma, baked from the donations given to the Kohanim. And the physical meal that we're about to partake of all of a sudden takes on a unique spiritual dimension. So that's why we wash our hands as far as Rav Kook is concerned, an added dimension to understanding it, to restore the perspective of a balance of what you're allowed to pursue and what you have to give to others. Almost kind of a mirror image of what I was describing with the dust. This can be seen here in the nature of salt and what it represents. Now, okay, so you given an opportunity to have this perspective, to make a bracha, to wash your hands before you partake. Now you spend the next hour eating, right? And you have a whale of a time. So of course, there's a risk here that the preparation that you did before you started eating, where you make yourself aware of the spiritual goal more than the physical, that's gonna dissipate the longer the meal takes and the more l'chaims you have. And so to counteract this negative influence, so says Rav Kook, we should wash our hands after the meal. And again, this ritual cleansing, you wash away the melach sedomit. It's not whether there's actually physical melach sedomit there or not. It's the attitude. The melach sedomit is the attitude of selfish preoccupation in sensual pleasures. That's the dangerous salt that you need to wash away, because if you don't wash it away, it'll blind your eyes. It'll impair your perspective to the needs of others. And therefore, my machronim, you know, is an antidote to the incorrect perspective. And this perspective is rendered harmless through the purifying ritual of my macaroni. So this is an interesting approach to the nature of salt and how it finds its way in the world of halacha as well. Now, it's interesting that if I asked you to make a connection between our parsha and salt, you'd go straight to the midrashim, which describe the fate of Lot's wife. She's of course the Rebbetzin of Sodom. You know, she represents a lot of what Sodom is, as opposed to Lot. Lot, in a way, is quite good compared to the rest of the chevra in Sodom. But his wife is really, she got her citizenship there. And this is how the midrash describes Lot's wife, at least according to the classic interpretation. And that is that there's a midrash that tells us that that Lot's punishment, Lot's wife, let's just call her by her name. Her name's Irit. The Ramban brings her name. So if Lot's wife, she was told like by the angels, don't look back. You know, Sodom is being destroyed, so don't look back. And she does. She looks back, and she's turned into a pillar of salt. Now, there are certain midrashim that talk about this. How many other people do you know turn into a pillar of salt? You know, what does that mean exactly? So, and why was she punished that way? So, the midrashim basically draw this parallel to what happened in Sodom before they fled. So two angels arrived in Sodom. Let's work with Rashi interpretation. Raphael and Gabriel arrive there. Lot sees them. He invites them home against the laws of the town, and he prepares them a good meal. He had seen this in Avraham Avinu's house, and according to the print, the midrash, the midrash tells us that it was Pesach. So Lot had baked matzahs. Now I wonder what that has to do with anything, but he's baked his matzahs. So Lot's wife, Irit, she was a native of Sodom. That Lot wasn't married, to the best of our knowledge, before he lands up in Sodom. So she doesn't, of course, have any sentiment like her husband does. She hasn't seen Avraham Avinu's hospitality. And she said to him, you, if people of Sodom find out, they're going to kill you. You're endangering all of us if you insist on having these guests. And she says, if you want to bring them into the house, let's write out a contract here and now. We divide the house into two, your section and my section. And that's where they're going to be. And the guests are going to stay, in your section. That's how the Midrash talks. Now, yeah, something interesting. The Midrash then brings out, the Bereishit Rabba brings out that Lot's wife was somebody who never allowed the guests to put, who never allowed, to serve anybody with salt. I'm not sure how she had guests because she was so anti them, but if she had them, she wouldn't serve, she would give them saltless food. So now Lot told her, you've got to serve them salt. And then she says back to him in the words of the Midrash, you want to bring this terrible minag here? We're not going to have salt in the house. And she left the house saying, I've got no salt. Where am I going to get salt? And Lot pushes her. So she says, okay, I'll have to go and borrow salt. So she goes and borrows salt from the neighbors. But this genius, what does she do? She runs around, knocking on her neighbor's door saying, listen, you know, my husband's driving me mad. You know, we have guests. Can you give me some salt? And that's how the people of Sodom knew that they had guests, because Lot's wife, with this whole salt story, she's the one who told everybody that the guests are there. So because of this, somehow the Midrash tells us that the punishment was to be turned into a pillar of salt, because she's the one who revealed the presence of the guests, of the angels, by going to her neighbors ostensibly to borrow salt, which means that the Midrash is trying to imply that maybe she wasn't even looking for salt. It was just an opportunity to tell the neighbors what her husband was doing. And this was life-threatening. And so this was a punishment for her revealing the presence of her guests as she went to her neighbors to ostensibly borrow salt. And so this is the kind of, again, salt metaphor that's brought to bear in the Sedra over here. Now, it's interesting that there's a Gemara in Masechet Brachot. You know, the Gemara tells us that when you see a place, a location where a miracle was performed, you have to make a bracha. So the Gemara in Masechet Brachot Daf Nun Dalet says a person who sees the place where Lot and his wife, or where Lot was told turning into a pillar of salt, Mevarchim Shtayim, you have to make two brachas. On Lot's wife, you say Baruch Dayana Emet, and on Lot you say Baruch Zocherat Et Tzadikim. You know, this is what you make a bracha on. So, you know, many are troubled with this whole story. You know, what kind of number one, why are you making a bracha over Lot being saved and his wife's being turned into a pillar of salt? And furthermore, the nusach of the bracha is very interesting, because the Gemara continues later on that when a person sees the place where Daniel and the lion's den took place, and that furnace where Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his three friends, were rescued miraculously, there you make a bracha which says, you know, Shasan Nais La Tzadikim Ba Makom Hazeh. But yeah, with Lot, you say Zocher Tzadikim. It's a different nusach, a different text of the bracha. And the interpretation that the Marsha and others give is that when you make a bracha when seeing the place of Lot, you're not making the bracha over Lot. Lot wasn't a tzaddik that deserved to be saved. He was only deserved to be saved because of the merit of Avram Avinu. So when you say Zocher Tzadikim, you're talking about Avram Avinu. Hashem remembered Abraham and therefore saved Lot. Now when it comes to Lot's wife, Baruch Dayana Emet, because she died there. She died there. Now, what's very interesting is that there's another bracha which is another way of looking at these two, at the relationship between these two brachas. And Dayana Emet and Zocheret HaTzadikim, these are, you know, if you interpret the fact that over Lot and his wife, you make both brachas, not one bracha for one, one bracha for the other, but over both of them, what do you see about that? And so, yeah, it's interesting that this is a kind of a test of faith that every human being sometime in their life is going to come across, some more than others. But that is when something really terrible happens in life. You know, you need to take a step back. And the only way to deal with it is to realize that Hashem controls the world. It's like salt. Sometimes a little bit of salt is fantastic. A big brocha makes everything taste amazingly. Too much salt is destructive. And so you have to always watch that out of every bag of salt will come something good. And so the same thing happened over here with Lot and his wife, right? This is out of the whole story of Lot. You know, Lot was left alone with his two daughters. They slept with him. Ammon and Moab came, and those two nations were the people who motivated Nebuchadnezzar to destroy the temple. They're the bad neighbors that the Gemara in Sanhedrin talks about. And at the same time, if it wasn't for the incest that took place between Lot and his daughters, Am Yisrael wouldn't have Mashiach. And so at the same, you know, the perspective on how we relate and Hashem relates to us, this perspective is the big lesson that's being massaged here into our daily lives. And I've just chosen these two areas, the dust of the angels on their feet and what it represents, and the salt of Lot and Melo and Sodomit, which also represents a challenge to us to develop a proper perspective on how we balance our engagement with the physical world and our service to HaKadosh Baruch Hu at the same time. So out of Parshat Vayera and these little elements, there's some lovely insights and lessons to be learned. And Hashem should bless us with the ability to develop the correct perspective on what is right, what is wrong, what is the balanced perspective. And, living through COVID and all of its corollaries, Hashem is possibly giving us a message here that, get the balance right, get things into perspective. What's really valuable? What really means things? What are we all about? And so with the correct perspective of how to balance, our involvement with HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the world, HaKadosh Baruch Hu should give us the bracha that he gave to Avraham Avinu, with who represented this perspective as a paradigm, as a man of faith. Okay, our time is up, so I'll leave you with those insights and
thank you very much. With you. And, thank you. I must say, when you said you wanted to talk on dust, I thought you meant when Avram first argues with God about storm, he says, "Hineinu ha'alti l'daber, v'anochi afar ve'efer." How can I speak because I'm dust? So I didn't, you took another aspect of dust in the parsha, but I think that's sort of a lead-in. If you want to spend half a minute commenting on the iPad's question, that perhaps the worshiping of the dust, I found those, by the way, commentary very, very fascinating. The Marella Prague and the Shlad was very, very fascinating, but perhaps it's the idea of worshiping man, that man comes from afar and he goes back to afar. So the worshiping of afar is the worshiping of man. I think that's a very interesting comment. I don't know if you want to add anything.
It's a good comment. It's a good comment.
Okay, so now we have a fourth explanation for what it means for Avraham Avinu.
We can find, we join the dots of all the areas where this metaphor, brings things alive,
Yeah, okay. Thank you. What time is Shabbos in Sydney this evening?
Oh, no, we got Minchas at 7 p.m., so we've got a while.
We've got the summer. It's only 12:30. It's only 12:30 Friday afternoon. Okay, go. Lunch. I'm not going to bed for hours, and you're going to go have lunch. Okay, very nice. Please, God, tomorrow morning when it's well into Shabbos in Sydney, 9:30 a.m., I'll be continuing my series on A Close Look at the Seder, 9:30 a.m. tomorrow. And next week, of course, we have all our nine regular series of Shirim, please, God, on tap, beginning with Rabbi Liebtag on Sunday morning at 11:15, the biblical number, 7, the Lost in Translation Monday, et cetera, et cetera. Next Thursday night's parsha is being given by Rivki Freundlich from Montreal. She's a Yoatzet Halacha. Her husband is the rabbi of TBDJ, Tiferet Beth David Jerusalem in Montreal. And we look forward to seeing you often between now and then. And I want to wish everybody well. And like I always say, please invite a friend to come to one of your shiurim. And in Sydney, there are probably lots of people who haven't heard of us. So we're always looking for people to join. And the time, they can come at night, 8:30. The daytime, it's lunchtime. It works out beautifully. Shiurim, 8:30 at night. So everybody, we will
I'll
put you on our email. I don't know if you get my emails. Okay, I'll send you afterwards. Thank you very much. Okay, want to wish everybody well. Good night. And
okay, Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom. Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
It's a small world, right? It's a small world out there. It's just it really is. It's beautiful. I find the whole thing that there are people, I don't know where everybody's from, but I know where some of the people are from. And of course, all over the United States and Canada and Israel. I mean, now I doubt there are too many people from Israel, but, in the daytime. And I think it's a beautiful thing to throw in Australia and it's mamash, very nice. And England, whatever, DJ from England. So it's very nice. Okay.
Thank you very much.
I think
much.
The truth is that we should have a whole shiur on salt, because there's the flip side of the coin where salt represents the salt on the mizbeach, right? Ran out of time. Right? I was debating whether I should do only salt, or throw in the dust as well.
Yeah, that's why I asked when you said dust, you know, okay, afar for afar. That's a beautiful shot there. The difference between afar and afar has a whole interesting analysis there. But yeah, very nice. Okay. Yeah, have a good Shabbos. Okay, be well. Should have a for good occasion.
Thanks, Rabbi. Come and be well. All the best to you.
Okay, very good. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you. Look forward to seeing everybody soon.
Yeah.